a 40-year-old man decided that it was time for someone to make and sell a fishing hunting boot that would keep feet dry and free from blisters. So in 1911, he fashioned a rubber and leather combination boot, and then he got the names of all of the non-residents who had hunted and fished in his state the preceding year, and he sent them an advertising piece, obviously advertising his boot. He sold 100 pairs of boots that first year for $3.50 apiece. 90 of those 100 pairs of boots quickly fell apart. Because he had made a promise in his advertising piece that he was making a 100% lifetime money-back guarantee, he received those 90 pairs of boots back in the mail. He borrowed $400 from his brother, and he promptly repaired the boots with a better design and sent them back to the purchasers. He soon added a few more products to his items for sale, and he sent out a small catalog. From the $400 of borrowed money, that turned into a $1 billion enterprise sold today through 50 specialty catalogs. You know the name of the company? L.L. Bean. It was 1954, and a 52-year-old man purchased a very different kind of restaurant in San Bernardino, California. 30 years later, by 1984, that little restaurant chain had grown to be 7,500 stores, and today it's 25,000 stores worldwide. The man was, as most of you know, Ray Kroc, and the company is known to us as McDonald's. To that list could be added Sam Walton, Bill Gates, Henry Ford, and many, many other men and women. Today we marvel at the size of their corporations and the value of their stocks. But what I want you to think about this morning instead are the initial investments they made. These men and women made relatively small but very strategic investments. Now, I can't prove what I'm going to say next, but I think they made those investments because of what they believed about the future. They envisioned a day when their ideas would be much more widely accepted and would hopefully be profitable. They saw a future, and they believed in that future. They believed in it enough that they made investments that others probably thought were crazy. Who would have thought that a fisherman from Maine could take on the then catalog titans of Sears and Ward's? Who would have thought that a little Arkansas retailer could compete with the giant Kmart Corporation? Others around them certainly thought they were foolish, but they believed something about the future, and because they believed that, they made an investment in it. In fact, they invested their lives in it. Consider this statement, please. Your vision of the future determines where you make your investments. Your vision of the future determines where you make your investments. I illustrate that in a rather crass way to begin with. Suppose you were to know that you would die in 30 days and someone gave you $1 million. How would you spend $1 million? Suppose you were to learn that you had only 6 months to live. How would you spend the next 180 days? Now, rather than going down either of those fanciful trails, let me ask you a much more important question. Knowing what you know about God and the kingdom that God is building, how are you now investing your time and your money in the future? Look with me, please, at a very short, but I think interesting story in Genesis chapter 23. Abraham and Sarah had been married for at least 60 years. We don't know much about the last 30 years of their marriage, their lives together, but we do know that the first 30 years of their lives together had tremendous ups and downs. They were constantly moving. They met near disaster several times, but it all ended some 30 years earlier than the story before us with the birth of their son Isaac, the promised son. Now, the author of Genesis, Moses, skips many years in Abraham's and Sarah's lives, but he picks their lives up again 30 to 35 years later, Genesis chapter 23. Would you stand, please, as I read it? Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Then Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. He said, I am an alien and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site so that I can bury my dead. The Hittites replied to Abraham, Sir, listen to us. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead. Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. He said to them, If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, the son of Zohar, on my behalf. So he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you. Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. No, my lord, he said, listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, Listen to me, if you will. I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so I can bury my dead there. Ephron answered Abraham, Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver, but what is that between me and you? Bury your dead. Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. So Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field, were deeded to Abraham as his property in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Afterward, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. You may be seated. The heading of this chapter in my Bible says the death of Sarah. But as we have just read the chapter, and I suspect you have noticed, there's very little about Sarah in the entire chapter. Verses 1 and 2 tell us that she died. They tell us where she died. They tell us how old she was when she died. And they tell us that Abraham went up probably from Beersheba. For some reason, he was there at the time while she was in Hebron. He went up and he mourned over her death. Then you go to the end of the chapter, verse 19, and you find out that Abraham buried his wife Sarah. Three verses tell us about Sarah. 16 verses in the chapter tell us about what? They tell us about Abraham purchasing land to have a cemetery. Now, why does Moses tell this story? I've already given you something of a hint of what I think it is by the way I introduced this message, but I want for you this morning to look at the clues in this text, which I think reveal to us why he does, in fact, tell the story. Even though it's a sad occasion, the death of Sarah, it is a rather fun story. Well, the negotiations between Abraham and the Hittite owner of the land sound familiar to any of us who have had the experience of buying something in a different culture. Now, most of us know what it's like to go into retail stores in our country where they mark the price and you pay the price that is marked. But if you've ever gone out garage sailing, or if you've spent time in Mexico, or if you've ever purchased a car or a house not through a sales agent, then you know something of negotiating a price and making a purchase. That's the experience that we have here in Genesis chapter 23. As I've already said, the story begins with a prologue. Sarah dies, and thus Abraham needs to find a place to bury her. The story ends with an epilogue. Abraham buries his wife in the cemetery that is purchased. But in between, we have the deal. And this deal, this transaction, is told in four stages. Stage one comes to us in verses 3-6. Abraham makes a request, and the owners of the land respond. In the text, we find that Abraham, first of all, acknowledges that he is on property. He is living on property that is not owned by him, but in fact is owned by someone else, namely the Hittites. Now, the Hittites were descendants of Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who was the son of Noah. Moses wants us to understand that, wants us to understand something of the context of who these people are, because that's very important. Now, Abraham and Sarah had moved to this part of the world because God had commanded them to do so. And God had promised that one day all of this land would belong to their descendants. But now, that is, in the time that Abraham is talking to these Hittites, in the time that Sarah has died, none of that land belongs to Abraham. It belongs to someone else, and that's very important in the story. Like the Spanish landing in Florida, or the Pilgrims landing in Plymouth Rock, this land is not vacant. It is already inhabited by other people. And so Abraham wants to purchase, to buy some of the land to make it into a cemetery. And so in this first stage of the deal, the Hittites respond by saying that Abraham is a well-recognized and well-respected leader among them, and he can have any grave that he wants, any grave that they already have. What I want you to note is that Abraham asked to purchase the land, but they are willing to give him a grave. Abraham asked to purchase it, but they will only give him a small piece. In their thinking, he would have a place to bury his wife, but he wouldn't own any of that land. And so the story moves on to stage two. Genesis chapter 23, verses 7 to 9. Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the Hittites. He said to them, "If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so he will sell me the cave at Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you." I want you to notice the formalities. Verse 7, Abraham rose up and bowed down before the people. We saw the same thing earlier in verse 3 alluded to, where it says that Abraham rose up before the people. We will see it again in verse 12, Abraham bowed down before the people. The Hittites are likewise very polite in this whole process. They refer to Abraham with great respect. There's something going on here. Have you ever noticed in our own courts of law how respectful people are, or at least ought to be, in that setting? The judge is referred to in a certain way. People are most often referred to by Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. The language is formal. Strict social courtesies are observed. And so it is here. And what we have is a legal proceeding. The city leaders are gathered together in the gate of the city, and Abraham is beginning formal negotiations with those leaders. So in the second stage, Abraham asks the leaders to intervene on his behalf with the very specific owner of the property he desires to purchase. He wants the leaders of the city to convince that owner to sell him that piece of property, a particular piece of property, and to sell it at a fair price. Now, you get the impression that the owner is already present in that group of people who are gathered together in the gate of the city, for that's where legal transactions took place. For the owner steps forward and he says this, "No, my lord. Listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in the field. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead." Now, I think this is kind of fun because in one sense, though everyone present knows exactly what Abraham is asking for and they know exactly what's going on, yet nobody is directly addressing the issue. Abraham is asking for something quite specific, and they are responding all around it, but not to the particular issue. Abraham wanted to own land in that country. And they are willing to let Abraham bury Sarah in their country, but they aren't certain that they want him to actually own land. Now, that method of kind of an indirect negotiation is even common today. I'll illustrate that a little later. But we move on to the third stage of the negotiations. Abraham presses his case, verses 12 and 13. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, "Listen to me, if you will. I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so I can bury my dead there." And again, Ephron, now the specific owner, or that is the owner of that specific piece of land, responds, "Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver, but what is that between me and you? Bury your dead." I find that exchange somewhat humorous. All along, Abraham had been asking to purchase the land. All along, the Hittites have been trying to avoid the subject, offering just a burial site instead. But when it finally comes to naming the price, Ephron the Hittite states the price but minimizes the price very quickly, as if somehow that's not significant. Surely that's nothing between me and you. I remember several years ago going with my brother, who then lived in Wisconsin, to visit a man from whom my brother intended to purchase a very expensive piece of machinery. I remember driving up to the farmhouse, and my brother and I got out of the car, and we walked up to the man's porch. He greeted us. We sat down on the porch, and my brother and that man spoke to each other for nearly half an hour on every subject except the reason why we were there. I kept silent, and I kept waiting for the deal to be discussed, but fairly soon my brother decided it was time for us to leave, and we got up and we got in our car and we began to drive away. When we got in the car, I said to my brother, "What's going on here? I thought we came to talk about this piece of machinery and the price that you are supposed to pay. Does the man even know why we were here?" He responded to me that the man knew exactly why we were there. And it would have been wrong for us to have discussed the price at that time. You see, a previous conversation had indicated that my brother was interested in the piece of machinery. This visit was just to verify that my brother was serious. And that was accomplished just by the visit, not by discussing the machinery. A subsequent conversation would take place, and it would complete the transaction, but there would be no haggling over the price. In the visit to the farmhouse that day, no one said anything about why we were there, but everyone knew why we were there. The conversation was going on at one level, but the deal was going on at another level. And that's what's happening here with Abraham. The conversation is polite, it is formal, it is at one level, but the real issues that are not being directly discussed, at least not by the Hittites, the real issue is being discussed or being held at another level. The real issue is that Abraham wants to own land. He wants to have a permanent place. He wants a place that will belong to him and to his descendants for generations to come. And the Hittites are not certain that they want this alien, this foreigner, to have landholder rights in their country. And so we move on to stage 4. Verse 16, Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms, and he weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. The deal is done. So Ephron's field, verse 17, in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field, were deeded to Abraham as his property in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Now, when you look back over the story, you notice that Moses, the author, has emphasized a number of things several times. In fact, it almost seems monotonous when you read it. Notice, please, that the exact location and the extent of the property is noted several times. Verse 2, she died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Verse 9, sell me the cave at Machpelah, which is at the end of the field. Verse 11, I give you the field and I give you the cave that is in it. Verse 17, so Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the border of the field were deeded to Abraham as his property. Verse 20, so the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham. When you get done reading it, should there be any doubt at all about where the land is and what was included in the property? None whatsoever. Secondly, what's Abraham or what's Moses emphasizing? He's emphasizing the name and identity of the seller. Verse 3, Abraham spoke to the Hittites. Verse 8, Ephron, son of Zohar. Verse 10, Ephron the Hittite. Verse 13, 14, 16, 17, who's named? Ephron. Is there any doubt about who sold the property and who that person is? None whatsoever. Thirdly, He emphasizes the fullness of the price. Verse 14, the land is worth 400 shekels. Verse 16, Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named, 400 shekels of silver. Note this addition, according to the weight current among merchants. Is there any doubt about the price and the fairness of the price? No, he's emphasized it. Fourthly, he has noted over and over again the public nature of the transaction, the public nature of it. Verse 3, Abraham spoke to the Hittites. Verse 7, Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. Verse 10, Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Verse 12, again Abraham bowed down before the people of the land. Verse 16, the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites. Verse 18, the property was deeded to Abraham in the presence of all the Hittites. Is there any doubt about the public nature of the transaction and that there were many, many witnesses? The location of the land, the extent of the land, the price of the land, the seller of the land, and the witnesses to the transaction are emphasized greatly. Why? So that there would be no doubt ever that this land now belonged to Abraham and to his descendants. The author is emphasizing the permanent nature of the transaction. Abraham was making an investment, a permanent investment. In what? In a cemetery only? No. Abraham is making an investment in the land of promise. Abraham now owns a piece of the promised land. 60 years earlier, God had said to Abraham, "To your offspring I will give this land." Chapter 13. Lift up your eyes from where you are, Abraham, and look north and south and east and west. All the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. Go, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. Chapter 15. To your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates. And Abraham believed the promise. Now note, please, that at this time the Hittites owned all of that land. Abraham had no idea how God was going to do it, but this land would one day belong to his descendants, and Abraham is now making an investment in that land. This is where he and his descendants would be buried. Abraham is taking steps to commit his descendants to the land of promise. By burying his dead here, Abraham is marking this place as home, even though at the time, he was a foreigner. That is faith. And that's an example, as the New Testament writers call it, an example for us. Abraham believed God, that all this land would one day belong to him and his people. That's why Abraham lived in the land, and that's why he's now investing in it, because this land is his future. I want you to see what the author of Hebrews in the New Testament said about this very thing. It's Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 to 16. All of these people, for the author has just named Abel, Enoch, Noah, and lastly Abraham, all of these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them, that is, in vision, and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted they were aliens and strangers on earth. That's the very language that Abraham had used. People who say such things, now this is not only Abraham and Enoch and others, this is all of us. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. For if they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Folks, God has declared with even greater certainty that our future is in the better country, the heavenly one. It is in the kingdom of God. The future that God is thinking of is millions of people from every people group of the world who know his grace and who are responding to his lordship in their lives. Listen to the way God describes the future. Psalm 2, ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance. Genesis 12, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. John 10, I have other sheep, Jesus said, that are not of this sheep pen. In other words, they are not all Jews. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. Matthew 24, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Matthew 28, therefore go and make disciples of all nations. The future that God is thinking of is us. It is us and our children knowing God and serving God and doing so here and now as well as in the kingdom that is yet to come when Jesus comes again. Revelation chapter 5. With Christ's blood, you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. That is our future. That is the future that God promises. Now the question for us, as it was for Abraham, is do we believe in the future that God says is going to come? Do we believe in that future sufficiently that we are investing in it? Abraham did not know how God would bring it to pass. But Abraham invested his life, he invested his family, he invested his fortune in the future that God was promising. Romans chapter 12, verse 1, the Apostle Paul says it this way, therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. The question is, where do you make your investments? Is our vision of the future only retirement programs, vacations, condominiums, and townhouses? Or is our vision of the future truly the kingdom of God? Where do you make your investments? It is the evidence of what you truly believe about the future. Peter and Stephanie Engel of our church next summer will be moving to Southeast Asia. Moving to Southeast Asia. Not visiting. They're going to live there. Why? Because they believe the future God has promised. And they are investing their lives in that future. Bob Buford, known to some of you from a couple of his books, was a Texas cable television pioneer. And in his very early 40s, Bob Buford came to the place in his life where he said that he had more money than he had meaning. And at that point in his life, he looked at what the future truly is. Not simply the future of cable television. Not simply the future of how much wealth he could amass. But he looked at the future that God had promised. And he said, that's the future I want to invest the rest of my life in, and even my fortune. There are scores, even hundreds, of people and families in this church who live modestly and who sacrifice things that they could have now or in the future because they believe in the future that God says is ours, and they are investing in it. I ask you this morning the obvious question. Where are you investing yourself, your time, and your money? Is it in the future that God has promised? Pray with me, please.